All right, this is our weekly Tanya class. We've been going through the meditations of Tanya from chapters 41 through 50. We are on chapter 50. So at the beginning of this chapter, he categorizes, well, first of all, just a little review. There are two major types of emotions, right?
Love and awe.
Love and awe, right? And he categorizes love and awe in some interesting ways. He says that love and awe are like water and fire, respectively. Chesed is often compared to, chesed is kindness, which is related to love, is often compared to water, because the nature of water is to flow downward. It seeks the lowest level. And fire, of course, goes upward. You know, when you're a little kid and you hold a match, and you hold it like this, and then you find out, you don't hold it like this, hold it like this. So fire goes upward, water goes down, fire goes up. So love goes down, awe goes up. What does that mean? It means that, generally speaking, the flow of love or kindness is from above to below, meaning to look at those beneath you. Like Avraham Avinu was the personification of chesed. So he was doing hachnasas orchim, he was constantly involved in hospitality. When we're talking about a love of Hashem, obviously it doesn't mean Hashem's beneath us, but what we mean is we want to bring godliness down into the world. So when we're talking about avas Hashem, it's sort of this feeling of bringing God down here, so that everyone can see him and appreciate him. Awe is the opposite tenua, movement, trajectory. It's like fire above to below. I mean, below to above. It strives upward. He says that it's the difference between Kohanim and Levim. In the Beis HaMikdash, that the Kohen is Ish Chesed, and the Levi is Gvura. And that's why the Levim were singing, because singing is an expression of striving upwards, almost a form of escapism, transcendence. At any rate, so he says that love in general can be categorized by this downward thrust. But there's an exception. There's this love, he calls it a love like gold. And he calls it a love like gold. I think it's meant to be, I don't know what I'm saying with thinking. It's pretty apparent that it's meant to be. I know. I mean, unless I'm completely off my rocker, it's meant to be a double meaning. Because he says that the advantage of this type of love is greater than other types of love, like the advantage of gold over silver. You know, gold is more expensive than silver. But it's also gold compared to silver. Gold is like silver with a little fire in it. That's what makes it red-ish. So imagine a love being generally like water or like silver. But this love has a little fire in it, which is normally characteristic of Gvura, normally characteristic of Yira, of the opposite axis. So what would that look like? So he says basically it's a love that instead of making you want to bring godliness into the world, it makes you want to leave the world behind. It's a form of love where you want to abandon your embodiment and become close to Hashem, even at the cost of losing your selfhood.
Like asceticism?
Hmm?
Asceticism?
Well, asceticism, I'm not sure if asceticism describes an ideology or a practice, because we don't really do it. At least in Chassidus, we don't do it. But I think asceticism is, I think, maybe I don't understand asceticism, but I think the idea is like to punish the body, to like sort of remove it as an impediment. Here, in other words, like the body's an obstacle, I need to get it out of the way, and then I'll be able to be more spiritual. I think here what we're talking about is that it's not even like the body is an obstacle, the body ceases to even be significant. There's just this such a powerful feeling of love for Hashem that it's almost like unavoidable. I can't help myself. I feel this need to abandon my physicality and become spiritually close to Hashem. He doesn't mention it here in Tanya, but in other places of Chassidus it often says that Aaron's two sons who died, Nadav and Avihu, they had this profound, passionate love for Hashem that caused them to die because they abandoned their embodiment and they had no interest in returning. So that's basically what it is. I don't know. I've heard that term used in very different contexts, but not in this one.
Okay, so is this recommended?
Is this recommended? That's a great question. Is this recommended? Is this prescriptive or descriptive? I always think that's a helpful question to ask. Are we telling you to do this? Are we just saying it's something that happens? So far, I think we're just saying something that happens. We're just describing a type of love. He's not really telling you yet. He's not telling you to do this. But based on this, he's going to tell you to do something, which
is... This is a result, a consequence.
No, it's not a result. Actually, it's a prerequisite. This is actually the setup. Yeah. This is just the setup. Okay, so basically what he says here is just going to read you some of the text. He does say v'efshe levar inyan zeh heitiv b'michtov. It's not really possible to explain this concept well in writing. This concept of it's not so much negating the physical body, because it's not even the intention to negate the physical body. It's like this love of Hashem that causes one to completely lose any concern for embodiment.
Isn't there a caveat to leaving the body, that wanting to return to build?
Well, have you learned this chapter before?
Yes.
And are you looking at the notes from when you learned this chapter before? And absolutely. Are you basically the guy sitting at Empire Strikes Back saying Luke Skywalker's father is Darth Vader?
I don't know what that is.
Yes, that's what you're doing. Okay. Yes, there's a caveat. But will you give me a chance to make it suspenseful?
Oh, please.
Okay, all right. Yes. Let me build it up. A little drama. All right, we'll get to the caveat. All right. Let's just look here. So he says, "V'hinei seder avayda be'esek ha'teira v'ha'mitzvus and m'shechus b'b'chines ava azazu hi b'b'chines shuv levad." This type of love that we're talking about. This fiery love, it is to serve Hashem in the manner of returning. Like it says in Sefer Yetzirah, v'imrotz libcha, if your heart runs away, shuv le'echad, return to the oneness. Pirush, what does that mean? V'imrotz libcha, if your heart runs away, he chukas ha'nefesh shebeleva b'chala yomani. That means the right ventricle of the heart, the nefesh elokis, is getting excited. Kishimis gaberis mislaheves umislahetis b'me'eid me'eid, when it gets very excited, ad kleis ha'nevesh mamish, even to the extent of expiration, lishtapach el chek avia chayachayim baruch hu, and it wants to pour itself out into the bosom of its father, the Holy One, blessed be he. Letzeis mimaisa baguf haguf nivagashmi ladav kabeis baruch. It wants to escape the imprisonment of the body. So when that happens, azai then, zois yoshev el libay, this is what you should place upon your heart, meaning here's the reminder, the caveat. Here's the caveat. Maimer Razal, the saying of our sages, ki al korchoch atuchai, against your will do you live. Baguf hazeh lahachayesei, in this physical body to enliven it. Kedei laham shechayim al yeinim mechayechayim baruch ulamata al yedei teiras chayim, to draw down life from the source of all life into the physical world through the Torah of life. Liyais, in order that there should be dira b'tachteinim, a dwelling place in the lower realms, lachdesis baruch bebechinas giloi, a dira b'tachteinim, a dwelling place in the lower realms for Hashem's oneness in a revealed way, down here, commissioners bar la'el, like it's explained previously. So he says like this, when you feel the intensity of that love that causes you to abandon yourself and want to lose your existence, then at that, precisely at that point, you sort of jujitsu that energy, you know, where you take the energy that's pushing in one direction, you channel it back into another direction. You take that very same energy, you don't nullify it, but you 180 it. You ever heard people say, I've done a complete 360 on that issue? You mean you believe the same thing you always did? Because 360 means you came all the way around full circle.
When you get to this place, you're halfway there.
So when you get to the place that we started off talking about, where you have this intense desire for Hashem to the extent where you have no more interest in being in this world, then you're halfway there. The other half is not to nullify that feeling, not to cancel it or allow it to dissipate it, but to channel it in a U-turn. That's what I'm calling the 180. To channel in a U-turn. Now, that sounds really, really difficult because it's like you're dealing with opposites and you have to make this hairpin turn. It sounds really difficult, but the way he explains it, actually, if you think about it, and that's what we're going to do, we're going to try to meditate on this, it's not so crazy. I mean, to me, the hardest part is getting up there to that point where you have that fiery desire to leave everything behind. But once you have that, the flipping it in a 180 U-turn, that actually makes sense to me. Because I'll say it in my own words. These are not really the words of Tanya, but I think this is the meaning. That if you really, really want to be close to Hashem, which is what he's describing a person with an intense longing to be close to Hashem, then just remember at that point where you're about to completely, irrevocably lose contact with your body, just remember for even 1 second, what does Hashem want? It's like, oh, you love Hashem? Okay, great. No problem. Well, what does Hashem want? Oh, yeah. Hashem wants his oneness to be revealed in the physical plane, the place of plurality. He wants his oneness to be revealed in the place that seems most inhospitable to oneness. So then you just, it's almost like the way to continue on the path is by turning around an exact 180 on that path. So the end result is you end up back in your embodiment doing mitzvahs, which is probably what you were doing before you started. But it's very, very different, because now you're back in your embodiment with a sense of spiritual purpose. You get what I'm saying here? Okay, yeah.
Not more than usual.
Not more, not less. Okay. That's a really tricky question. The question is asked in earnest. I'm saying it's tricky to answer. Ever hear the question? I'll repeat it. We're talking about the Nefesh HaLakias here, the godly soul. So you're saying pretty much a definition of the Nefesh HaLakias is that its desires are only for God, so how could it ever have a desire that's not aligned with God? In other words, why would it need to be corrected?
Well, is this a desire, or is this just the path towards that ultimate?
Well, I think that's a good way of saying it. Is it as a desire or a path? In other words, its desire doesn't really change. Its desire is oneness with God. That never changes. It's like, shucks, I was wanting the wrong thing. Let me change that. The Nefesh HaBahamas has to correct its desires all the time. But it's not about correcting the desire. It's not even about correcting the path, because it's like, it's not like, oh, if I would have known this before I started, I would never have gone out of my way like that.
You can't get this without going.
It's a process. And even though it seems like, well, hold on, if the end point is that you come back into your body, then you should have stayed. That's where you started. You should have stayed there. If you would have known all this, you never would have gone up and come back down. It's almost like an inversion of, you read a Letzedech Aliyah, you know that concept of you have to go down in order to come back up, you crouch down, you go down low in order to spring up high, right? This is kind of the opposite. It's like going up high in order to come back down low with more force. So it's not a correction like a, oh, I wish I would have known that in the first place, I never would have started on this journey. It's more like, here's the process, here are the steps you go through. Step one, I mean, it depends how far you want to back up, but, you know, we'll start with step one. Think about Hashem until all you want is closeness with Hashem, and you, when that first starts to set in, you're going to feel that as a desire for closeness with Hashem, which will automatically cause you to lose a connection with your physicality.
But that's what doesn't make sense, because the connection to the physicality
is
what Hashem wants.
Spiritual velocity.
Why does that happen?
Why does it happen? Because
sometimes
two souls. Yeah, we're only talking about one of them. That's a great answer, but we're only talking about one of them here. Yeah, but we're not talking about it's not
a wrong path.
That's what I said before. We're not talking about an animal soul that goes on the wrong path and needs to be corrected. Look,
it's a
dynamic process. Don't think about it like I don't know how to say this without repeating what I said before, but don't think of it like, oh, if I would have known all this information to begin with, I never would have engaged in this process. It's more like, this is the process. This is how it happens. These are the stages. It's not, the godly soul is not incorrect. These are the stages. This is the process. It's not really avoidable. Is that not making sense?
The soul should be jumping at the opportunity to be embodied.
It doesn't say it's painful. It says it's against its will. It says, "Al korchoch atochai," against your will.
But isn't it God's will? That's the soul's will. It should be the will.
You're saying, why isn't the will of the soul from the very beginning embodiment? Because anybody who wants to be here, it's called the catch 22. You know about the catch 22? The original catch 22? Before it became an idiom?
Because it needs the body to service it. When we first come into embodiment, the body is not serving the soul. When we make that 180 and we come back down, now the body is in support and service of the soul, so it's happy to be in that embodiment.
But this whole meditation is when it's not, it loses touch with that. If that was so holy, why would we lose touch with that, even for a moment?
No, we lose touch with it, the original one, the original embodiment.
Okay, so I'm going to get accused of turning this into a story about his kashrus, but you know what? Maybe then this will be the way you understand why a relationship with a Rebbe is not just that the Rebbe teaches you how to have a relationship with God, but a relationship with a Rebbe is actually part of understanding your relationship with God. So I'm going to tell you a story about a Rebbe and a Chassid. There was a young man who was raised in a religious home, and when he was in his teens, he went away from Yiddishkeit, and he went and got a job. He lived in Haifa, in Eretz Yisrael, and he worked on a construction site, and he did this for a while, and then finally he got bored of it. He used to make money driving a tractor, and then at night he would go to the discos and party. And eventually it got boring, and he told his father he wants to go back to yeshiva. So his father was very happy, and then basically he decided to go to Chabad. And the father was like, "Are you sure?" Like, they had no connection to Chabad. He was like, "Yeah, this is where I feel comfortable." So he went to Chabad, and they told him, "Look, you know, you're very, like, behind, and you're older than the other students. You haven't been in yeshiva for a while." So he says, "Don't worry, I'll catch up." And they said, "And you don't know chassidus, because you come from a background where they don't learn chassidus." So he's like, "Don't worry, I'll catch up." So basically what he did is, the same way that he used to work all day and party all night, and he knew how to, like, get by with very little sleep, so when he went back to yeshiva, to the Chabad yeshiva, he would go to class all day, and then at night he would pay different students to tutor him on all the things that he had missed, they needed to catch up on. Anyways, very quickly he became like a star student, and he says he wants to go to New York to meet the Rebbe. And normally, students of that age, they didn't encourage them to travel from Israel, because whatever, it was like considered like, not necessarily can everyone handle the trip and use it for the right purposes. But the Rosh Hashiva decided this Bacher was older and more mature, and look, he'd already experienced all the craziness that's out there, so it's not like he's going to see anything in New York he didn't already experience. So they told him, "You can go to the Rebbe." So he went to New York, and from the time he met the Rebbe, basically decided, you know, this is it. I'm staying here. And that's what he did. And he stayed in 770 for many years. His first yechidus, his first personal audience with the Rebbe, he wrote a whole long letter, basically about what he's learning in yeshiva. And the emphasis of the letter was basically all of his learning and his davening, everything he's doing now. Now, for the purposes of full disclosure, he did write his background. Like, he wrote the whole story about how he was out of yeshiva and he was working in a construction site. And, you know, he did write that. But the main thing is, the bulk of the letter was all about the spiritual stuff he's involved in now. So, anyways, he brought his letter into to Yechidus, and they told him that whatever the first thing that Rebbe says to you in Yechidus sets you up for your life. It's like it becomes the theme of your life. So the Rebbe read the entire letter. I think it was many, many pages. And when the Rebbe finished the letter, this young man was expecting, you know, the Rebbe is going to pick one of, he wrote a lot of holy stuff in the letter, so the Rebbe is going to pick one of those things to zero in on, and that's going to be like the theme of his life. And after reading the whole letter, the Rebbe says to him, so you know how to drive a tractor, which he had mentioned in the letter in passing as part of like the background, but he was devastated. He was devastated because that was like, to him, a very shameful thing that was associated with what he was trying to get away from. So he's like, yeah, and then the Rebbe changed the subject to other things, and he hoped that basically that would be forgotten and never mentioned again. Anyway, so he stayed in 770 for many years. He was known that he had a, anytime he wanted Yechidus, he could request one, he could come in to see the Rebbe, very, very unusual. He was known as the one Bacher who was always learning until the Rebbe's light went out. You know, the Rebbe's light in his office only went out for a few hours a day. The Rebbe slept very, very little. And this Bacher would learn whenever the Rebbe was in his office, this Bacher was sitting and learning. Okay, so finally came a day where the Rebbe, this young man was in Yechidus, and the Rebbe says to him, you need to go back to Haifa and get your job driving the tractor. So he started crying because it's not, you know, he had spent years getting away from that. And the Rebbe told him he should go back there. So he started crying. And the Rebbe says to him, I don't know why you're crying. Mamonoshach. Either way, you got to leave now. Because if I'm a Rebbe, then I know where your neshama belongs. And I'm telling you, you have to go get your old job back. And if I'm wrong, if I'm sending you to the wrong place, then clearly I'm not who you think I am. And why would you waste your life being next to me? You should go out on your own now. You know, go find something else. Go somewhere else. Anyways, it was very, very, very painful for him. But he took the orders and he went. He left. Anyways, the long story short is...
Is this Reuven Donin?
Yeah, it's Reuven Donin, yeah. So the long story short is that being a tractor driver, he was able to be makat of thousands of people who would never, ever, ever speak to a rabbi. Extremely, extremely anti-religious people who would never speak to a rabbi. Forget about it, they would never go to a shul. If they saw a rabbi walking down the street, they would cross the street. They wouldn't want to speak to a rabbi. But they spoke to him because he was a regular guy. They worked with him. They knew him. And he was able to reach thousands of, like, a really crazy number of people. It's actually fascinating how many people I've met personally who have told me, oh, yeah, that's how they became from, is they or their parents met Reuven Donin. Yeah. So at any rate, so the Rebbe knew what he was doing, right? Like sending this guy. But, yeah, what's this called?
I think it's in Hebrew.
Uh-huh. But there's a book. Okay, fine. But the point is, that was the last place he wanted to go. Oh, but the Rebbe knew that he needed to be there because that's how he was going to be able to reach these Jews, only from that job. If he would have been a rabbi in the same neighborhood, they wouldn't speak to him. He had to be one of the guys. Okay. So the point of the story is not that, oh, the Rebbe knew that this guy needed to be a tractor driver in order to be able to be makat of these anti-religious people. That's not the point. Like, what's the pella there? The Rebbe was very good at shluchim placement, okay? Like, we know thousands of examples. It's not the point. The point of the story is, if he was destined to sit on top of that tractor and be Mikado people, then why not just leave him there, because that's where he started? So you say, well, because he needed to go to yeshiva first. He did. He started in yeshiva. So why did he have to go through this whole process? And why did he have to go through the heartbreak of thinking that he was never going to have to go back to that place and then find out that that's precisely where he belongs? So I guess in the story, the tractor changed meaning to him. It used to mean one thing, and then it came to mean another thing. So for the Nefesh HaLokis, embodiment changes meaning. The Nefesh HaLokis never changes what it wants. It wants God. But at first, its relationship with the body, the circumstances of embodiment, think about how strange it is for the godly soul to be ripped out of its paradise in heaven and plunged into a body. So at first, embodiment is a disruption, and it really is a disruption, because compared to what it had before, its relationship with Hashem, the godly soul had a very nice relationship with Hashem in heaven, basking in the rays of godliness. And embodiment was disruptive of that. But then, when the godly soul becomes more integrated with the body, or maybe we should say the reverse, the body becomes more integrated with the godly soul and becomes more of like a hand-in-glove type relationship, where the body is a vehicle to express the godly soul's desire, which ultimately is God's desire, so then the godly soul feels differently about embodiment. It's not that the godly soul was wrong to begin with. Those were the circumstances. Under those circumstances, embodiment was an interruption to the relationship. Later on, embodiment becomes an expression, or the expression, perhaps, of the relationship. It's not a question of being wrong and correcting yourself. It's an evolution. It's a process. But the bigger question is like this. Why can't we save ourselves from all this heartache and just get the punchline at the beginning? You ever heard this one? You want to hear a joke backwards? Okay, start laughing. Why can't we start with the laughing? Why not just get to the punchline first? If we all know the punchline, who doesn't know that this is where it ends? So this is what I was saying before about the catch-22. What's catch-22?
That you're stuck.
What?
You're stuck.
What is the actual reference? Nobody even Googled it? No one bothered to Google it? I don't make these pop culture references to prove that I'm cool. Trust me.
It wasn't in the footnote.
Right? It wasn't in the footnote? When we'll write up the shiurim, there's going to be some poor guy having to Google all these pop culture references and put links in to Wikipedia articles. Okay. The Catch-22, or the original Catch-22, is a novel by Joseph Heller. And it's about a guy who's in the Korean War, an American soldier. And he wants to leave. No, no, he's not in the Korean War. He's in World War II. Sorry, MASH was Korean War. He's in World War II. And he wants to, JFYI, I never read MASH or Catch-22, but you don't need to. No, no, MASH was Korea, for sure. It was Korea. Yeah, 100%. 100%, yes. Okay. Okay. So you can Google it right now. Yeah, I'm the scholar of these references. Okay. So the main character, he wants to leave the army, and they tell him that only crazy people can, you know, you get a Section 8, you can get thrown out of the army. But anyone who wants to leave the army is clearly not crazy. So if you want to leave, you're not crazy. But if you want to stay, then you're crazy, and then you have to go. What? You found it?
No, it says World War II.
I have Green Lantern.
You're looking up MASH, and you're looking up Catch 22.
I looked up Catch 22.
Okay. So peace in the world. Okay.
So no one could ever leave.
That's the Catch 22, is that the people who are supposed to leave can't leave, and the people who want to leave can't leave.
Why is it Catch 22 and not Catch 23?
I believe it's just a random number that adds to the absurdity of it.
It's
it's random. Yeah, okay.
But there's no random.
So, but the point is like this, that if you want to leave, then you clearly are sane, and then you must stay, because only crazy people can leave. Tell you another story. There was a rabbi who spent his entire life focused on nothing but serving Hashem, to the extent where he avoided even the most basic physical comforts. He slept on a wooden bench in shul. He didn't even sleep in a bed. And at the end of his life, he was passing away. And
was he married?
Yes. He had an arrangement. His wife was okay with it. So he was passing away, and he was crying. And he was saying, I wish I hadn't slept on a bench, because I realize now that it depleted my body. And if I would have slept on a more comfortable mattress, or a mattress at all, I guess, maybe I would have lived another day. And in that day, I could have put on tefillin one more time. That's what he was crying about on his deathbed. Okay. So afterwards, the chassidim were playing Monday morning quarterback, and they were analyzing this very heartsick episode. And they sort of, you know, Chassidim have a penchant for the ironic. I don't know if you know that, but they do. So somebody said, he's crying because he wishes he took it easier on his body so he could live one more day and put on tefillin just once more. But don't you realize? The only guy who cries when he's about to die and the only thing he's going to miss from the physical world is tefillin, is the guy who slept on a bench for 30 years. So in order to be the guy who says, oh, if only I could put on tefillin one more time, the only way to do that is to sleep on a bench for 30 years, which will make you probably die a little bit earlier than you would have, and then you're going to cry about all those days you missed that you could have put on tefillin. But the guy sleeps in a comfortable bed and does live longer, and therefore can put on tefillin more days, that's not what he's crying about when he's leaving the world. By the way, you know the perfect classic Jewish joke to insert right here at this point. And if this were like an evening lecture and not a class of serious students, I would at this point insert this story. You know the Catch 22. Murray's on his deathbed. It's always Murray or Bernie. Yeah. He's on his deathbed. And he smells something. What does he smell? He smells his wife's brisket. Ah, and he remembers all those Friday nights where Shirley served the brisket.
Shirley.
Yeah.
Or Ethel.
Yeah, Ethel. And he says, to his wife, dear, I smell the brisket. Before I leave this world, could you bring it to me one last time so I could taste your exquisite brisket? She says, Murray, I'm sorry. It's for the Shiva. Oh, that's for after.
Did the rabbi on the bench have children?
Yeah. They slept on little benches next to him.
Okay. Is this idea of the soul making that 180, coming back into the embodiment in a more elevated level, integrated, is that like Dira B'Tachtonim?
Well, he says Dira B'Tachtonim. He says that the objective that the soul is returning to the body for is Dira B'Tachtonim. It's not returning for brisket.
Right.
It's returning for Dira B'Tachtonim.
Okay.
Right. Is Dira B'Tachtonim a Chabad idea? No, but it would be disingenuous not to admit that Chabad emphasizes it a lot more than any other strain within, even within Hasidic Judaism.
Wait, did the Baal Shem Tov talk about Dira B'Tachtonim?
Yeah, for sure. And that's why the Baal Shem Tov spoke about not, well, you mentioned asceticism at the beginning of the class. That's why the Baal Shem Tov rejected asceticism, and you have to support the body, integrate the body into the Avodas Hashem. Yeah. To be honest with you, just to sum up nine generations of Chassidus in one sentence, yes, the theme of Dira B'Tachtonim became increasingly more emphasized, especially by the Rebbe, yes.
Why?
Now you're asking my theory.
Yeah.
Because we're getting closer to Mashiach and it becomes more and more the job.
Because it seems like in some maybe non-Chassidic cultures, some people, like holy leaders, get to this.
It's a very valid and astute observation. So I'll tell you another story real quick. You heard of the Maram Mirottenberg?
Yeah.
It's a children's book.
Nope.
He was held for ransom. He was in a tower. No story. Okay, fine.
Sounds like Rapunzel.
Rapunzel, yeah, but he didn't have long hair. Maybe he had a long beard. I don't know. Okay. Rapunzel, Rapunzel, let down your hair.
Yes.
Yes.
I'm waiting.
Okay, so the Maram was held ransom, and he told the Jews, "Do not pay the ransom, because then they're gonna make a business out of rabbi napping." So he died in captivity. He died in captivity. I'm telling you the story very, very quickly. It's late. He died in captivity. So after he died, they wouldn't even release his body for a Jewish burial. And there was this wealthy Jew. His name was Alexander Vimfin. And he was the one who finally arranged for the burial of the Maram. So long story short, he arranges for the burial. I believe it was in Ir. And this story happens like months later. I think it was like during Tishrei. Anyways, he has a dream that the Maram comes to him and says, because you arranged that I should have a Jewish burial, I am being given permission in heaven here to reward you with one of two rewards. You can pick one. One is what he calls imi b'michitzasi, with me in my compartment, basically be my roommate in heaven. So they're talking about somebody who's got like, I mean, you can only imagine the Maram's situation in Gan Eden. So he's like, you could be on my level with me. Or the money that you spent getting my body released will be made up to you, and you and your descendants for all time will be wealthy.
Hmm.
See, you can pick one or the other, but if you want to go to my level in heaven, then the train is leaving tomorrow. So you gotta decide tomorrow. Meaning you gotta pass away tomorrow.
Hmm.
So he gets up, And he realizes the dream is real, and he speaks to his wife, and he tells her about the two options. Either I can go, you know, die today and go to the Mount Adam's level in heaven, or I can get money, and we'll be rich, and our children, and our grandchildren, I'd say if Kolodotus, all of our descendants will be wealthy. So she's like, well, which one do you want to do? And he's like, well, I'm kind of thinking the Gan Eden, you know, it's eternal. So let's go for that, if you're okay with it. And she said, okay, yeah, that's, you know, we'll call the kids together. They had a family meeting, and basically, and he died, and that's it. And then they buried him next to the Mount Adam. Okay, so there was a Chassidish HaMashpia, Reb Hill Paracher. Now, he was a chassid going back to the times of the Alter Rebbe. It's actually a whole interesting story. He never met the Alter Rebbe, but he was in the times of the Alter Rebbe, in the times of the Mittler Rebbe, the Alter Rebbe's son, in the times of the Tzemach Tzedek, who was the Alter Rebbe's grandson. He used to tell this story. I don't know if he told it all the time, but apparently he used to, at Fabrengens, he would tell this story. And then after he would tell the story, he would ask the people there, so if you were Rebbe Alexander, which would you take? And apparently, this is why I'm telling you the story, that even though he's sitting and talking to Chassidim, most of them would say, oh, I would be like Alexander, because they thought that was the noble thing. Oh, go for the spirituality. Of course, you do the spiritual thing, not the material thing. And then he would like flip it on them and be like, well, who benefits from that other than you? Take the money and think about all the people that you could help. So you're going to go to a higher level of Gan Eden? Good for you. But if you take the money, then you can actually do something for others. And that was like considered, I guess that was a surprise. That was a twist. So I guess I'm answering your question by saying, yeah, it is an emphasis in Chabad, and it's become more and more of an emphasis, and it is unexpected. And yeah, it is something that needs to be reinforced, because it is to some extent counterintuitive. Yeah.
Then again, this guy was already rich.
He was already rich, so yeah, he knew what that was.
Exactly.
He wanted to try something new.
And a higher level.
Start with the left.
Oh!
I can't go.
Okay, so let's wrap it up here. Okay.
Because you just can't.
Okay, so, but why? You're correct. Okay. So, you know what makes a joke funny?
The person telling it.
What?
The person telling it.
That's how you tell it, right.
Depends on the
person. Okay. But delivery, yes. But I'm saying. So just say punchlines.
Opposites,
unexpected. It's the juxtaposition of setup and punchline. It's tension. Tension, release. Same thing with drama, by the way, is also tension, release.
Like this
class. Yeah, I hope so. Which is why you don't walk in Empire Strikes Back and tell somebody that Darth Vader is Luke Skywalker's father. Because then there's no tension, release. Okay.
So in your story, the higher level of Gan Eden was still a room share.
It's like Manhattan.
Oh.
So what's the tension in the first 180? Like in the first half?
So the tension is like the story of Reuven Dunin. That tractor only becomes his shlichus when he doesn't want to be there. So that's what the Rebbe said to him. I don't get it. And now you got to leave. Because if I'm a Rebbe, I know where you belong. And it's far away from me. If I don't know where you belong, then you should want to go far away from me anyways, because who am I? I'm a guy who has bad ideas about your life. But the point is, it becomes his destiny when it's the last place that he wants to be.
Is it the same question as why put us in the garbage heap in the first place? Is it essentially the same question?
I hadn't thought of that.
Just to take us out of the garbage heap? Ooh,
so
I would intuitively, the answer is yes.
But, so I have a question about that. Because I have an issue with that whole thing. The garbage heap and putting you there and that whole thing. But on this, it makes so much sense.
Yeah, what's the difference?
That's my question. Like, for the spiritual progression, it makes sense. And I don't have a question of the soul doesn't want that. It makes sense. Like, okay, it needs this journey.
Okay, so maybe this is the answer that you've been looking for. Now you have a model for it that works for you.
But I think I have that. I understand the model, and my issue is why Hashem created that model. That I'm still finding. Spiritually, it makes sense, and I feel like I could swallow it. But when it's physically, when it's garbage heap and Mitzrayim, I can't.
Okay, so all jokes have the same basic formula, but not everybody will laugh at the same jokes.
Yeah, something popped up on your screen.
It's okay.
So I feel like, I guess the drama and the intensity in the spiritual realm, and then the
some people will tell you, that joke's not funny, I won't laugh at it. And other people will laugh at it. So
not everybody's great at telling over jokes.
Even the same joke, same joke teller. So for you, the story... Every story is the same formula. Every joke is the same formula.
I'm not thinking in terms of stories or jokes. I'm thinking...
I know, but I'm saying that metaphorically.
Yeah.
Every conflict is the same conflict.
Right. It's the blueprint that Hashem...
It's the same paradigm. Sometimes you're comfortable with it. In other contexts, you're totally not comfortable with it. I would assume, a bold assumption, but I'm probably right, it's based on your experiences. Of course. Perhaps. Perhaps. We all have different associations with different concepts. Okay, yeah, maybe that's precisely why. Like, if this one triggers you the wrong way, okay, let's try. Right, but Mitzrayim becomes a growth experience when you don't want to be there. But for the 4/5 who stayed there, it wasn't a growth experience. So, is Mitzrayim a growth experience? It depends.
Then you have a choice. Do you want to stay there and die there, or do you want to have a geula? But that's the spiritual Mitzrayim.
Right.
I guess my issue is
anyways, the point is, it's not about the destination. This sounds so trite. I hate being trite. It's not the destination, it's the journey. But it really is. It's so trite, but it really is. It's the process. Because you could just take a slice of that punchline and it doesn't have the value. It's all about the context. If the Reuven Dunin story starts with him already on the tractor and then he doesn't leave it and go back to it, and he, it's
but
not the story.
Hashem made it that way. Hashem could have made him in the tractor.
Yes. And to a certain extent, Hashem is also going through this. But there's also a Hashem story, because you get asked the same question. If Hashem wants to do it, but Tachnanim so much, why didn't he just make it that way? And the answer is, well, he did. And then he was like, no, this isn't satisfying. Gan Eden originally was. Originally, Adam and Chava were in Gan Eden. It wasn't good enough. And he said, you know what? Let's have you mess it up and then fix it. And then it'll be a Adir B'Tachtenim. When you messed it up and you fixed it. Which is also the same concept. That it has to be a process. It's not just the end result. It's the process. That's why you can't just say, you want to hear a joke backwards, start laughing. No, you have to go through the stages.
But sometimes that process is too overwhelming for someone to even...
Yes. Yes, and yes. Sometimes the process... Sometimes the setup for the joke isn't worth the punchline.
Often, not often, but sometimes it's when you come out of it. When you come out of the crime and you reflect back.
Right.
Then you can then use that reflection and what you acquired...
There's always these patterns repeat on higher and higher levels. Okay.